Chapter 33. The time sped away swiftly as the locomobile ate up the 120 miles between the two cities in 9 minutes under 2 hours. The last light was glimmering over the ocean to the west when they dropped down from Mount Soledad toward the heart of the city that opened up before them like a carpet of buildings tinted gold by the final rays of the setting sun. Though the locomobile sported huge acetylene headlamps, Bell did not wish to take the time to stop the car and light them. "How's our gas?" Bell asked in a rasping voice, his mouth coated with dust. Bronson turned in his seat, unscrewed the big gas tank cap, and dipped a stick down to the bottom. He withdrew the stick and stared at the moisture at its very tip. "Let's just say we'll have to finish the race on fumes." Bell nodded without answering. The grinding strain had taken its toll on him. After hours of twisting the big steering wheel in 1,000 gyrations to turn the stiff linkage to the front wheels, his arms felt numb, as if they were no longer a part of his body. His ankles and knees also ached from constant clutch, accelerator, and brake pedal action. And both his hands were blistered inside his leather driving gloves. Yet Bell drove at full throttle the last few miles, forcing the locomobile to leap toward the final destination like a bear sprinting after an elk. The locomobile was badly worn down, too. The knobby tread on the Michelin tires was nearly shredded. The wheels were wobbling from the beating they had endured. The faithful engine was beginning to emit strange noises, and steam was billowing from the radiator cap. Still, the magnificent machine pushed on. "I wonder what's in Cromwell's mind," said Bell. "He's too late to commit robbery today. The bank is closed until tomorrow morning." "This is Friday," answered Bronson. "The banks in San Diego stay open until 9 o'clock in the evening." They were sprinting down India Street, parallel to the railroad tracks, with the depot no more than a mile away, when Bell flicked his eyes from the road for an instant and glanced in the direction of a train with only one car that was slowing to a halt. The locomotive pulling the private Pullman car came to a stop on a siding 4 tracks over from the street. Smoke lazily rose from its stack as the engineer vented steam from exhaust tubes. The fireman had climbed on top of the tender, preparing to take on water from a large wooden tank. With the growing darkness, lights blinked on in the Pullman car, which was now parked a mile away from the depot and the city's downtown. Bell knew immediately that this had to be Cromwell's private train. He did not hesitate. He spun the wheel hard left and sent the locomobile bouncing wildly across the railroad tracks. By the time he had bounded over 3 tracks, he had blown all 4 of the badly worn tires and rolled the rest of the way up to the train on the rims of the wheels, showering sparks like meteors as they smashed against the steel rails. Bronson said nothing. He had been frozen in confused shock until he saw the train and realized what Bell had up his sleeve. Excitement grew to elation at knowing that after their 500-mile daredevil drive, they had finally come within spitting distance of their goal. Bell slammed the locomobile to a stop across the tracks in front of the locomotive. Its momentum finally spent, the battered automobile sat forlornly with its overheated engine crackling, its radiator hissing steam, and the smell of shredded tires. Its mad and wild chase had come to a fitting climax in front of the quarry it had pursued through the backwoods of hell. "We may be jumping the gun," said Bronson. "He hasn't attempted to rob the bank yet. We can't arrest him without a crime." "Maybe. But on the drive down here from San Francisco, I had much to think about. Better we take Cromwell now, before he has time to act. If he sees through our trap again, we're lost. I'll worry about gathering enough evidence to convict him later. Besides, he's not on home ground. He can't call in expensive attorneys to get him out on bond." Bell was well aware that no one had had the time to exit the train during the few minutes since it had come to a standstill. He climbed from the automobile and walked unsteadily toward the Pullman car, the aches and pain and weariness slowly falling away. He halted abruptly and slipped between the Pullman and the coal tender as two stewards wrestled the motorcycle from the car to the ground beside the track. He waited patiently for a few minutes until a man dressed in the uniform of a railroad conductor stepped from the Pullman car and threw one leg over the seat of the motorcycle that Bell recognized as a Harley-Davidson. The man's back was to Bell as Bell stepped silently alongside the Pullman car and stopped only when he was no more than 5 feet behind the man who was leaning down to open the fuel valve to the carburetor in preparation for starting the engine. "The Harley is a good machine," Bell said calmly, "but I prefer the Indian." The man on the motorcycle froze at the sound of the familiar voice. He slowly turned and saw an apparition standing behind him. Eerie illumination fell from overhead electric lights along the railroad siding. The figure wore a short leather coat over jodhpurs and boots that looked like they had been dragged through a swamp. A pair of goggles was pushed back on his head, revealing strands of blonde hair coated in dried mud. But there was no mistaking the face, the piercing eyes, and the begrimed mustache that covered the upper lip. "You?" "Not very original," Bell said cynically. "But since I used the same expression at the bank in Telluride, I won't criticize." A silence came over the two men that seemed to last a lifetime, but it was only the few seconds that it took Cromwell to see that the apparition really was Isaac Bell. Cromwell just stood there in growing disbelief, his face suddenly turning pale. "You were dead," he gasped. "I shot you." "Twice, as a matter of fact," said Bell with a hard edge to his voice. His right hand gripped the 1905 Colt 45 automatic, its muzzle aimed squarely between Cromwell's eyes and held as steady as an iron bar in concrete. For the first time in his life, Jacob Cromwell was taken completely off guard. His agile mind, filled with overconfidence, had never considered how he would act should the time ever come when he was apprehended. The unthinkable was never dwelled upon. He had always thought of himself as untouchable. Now he stood face to face with his archenemy, who should have been dead. He felt like a captain whose unsinkable ship had run up on the rocks. Cromwell's Colt 38 was in his coat pocket, but he knew Bell would blow his brains out before he could reach for it. Slowly, he lifted his hands into the air in abject defeat. "What happens now?" he asked. "I'm going to borrow your special train to take you back to San Francisco. There I'll turn you over to the police until such time as you're tried for murder and hung. You have it all mapped out." The day had to come, Cromwell. You should have quit when you were ahead. "You can't arrest me. I have committed no crime." "Then why are you disguised as a railroad conductor?" "Why don't you shoot me now and get it over with?" Cromwell asked, his composed arrogance coming back on keel. "A mere slap on the hand for your crimes," Bell said caustically. "Better you have plenty of time to think about the hangman's noose tightening around your murdering neck." Bronson came from around the rear of the Pullman car, his Smith & Wesson double-action 44 revolver drawn and pointed at Cromwell's chest. "Nice going, Isaac. You nabbed our friend here before he could commit another crime." Bell handed Bronson a pair of Tower nickel-plated double-lock handcuffs. The agent wasted no time in snapping them on Cromwell's wrists. Then he gave the bandit a thorough search and found the 38 Colt automatic. "The weapon you used to commit 36 murders," Bronson said with a cold voice. "Where did you come from?" Cromwell demanded at seeing Bronson and knowing with certainty that these men would not hesitate to shoot him if he gave the slightest indication of trying to escape. "Isaac drove us from San Francisco in his automobile," he answered as if it were an everyday event. "Impossible," snorted Cromwell. "I thought so, too," said Bronson, leading Cromwell up the steps into the Pullman car, where he took his own handcuffs, placed them around Cromwell's ankles, and roughly shoved him onto a couch. Bell walked back up the track and stared sadly at the mauled locomobile. A barrel-chested man carrying an oil can in the coveralls and denim-striped hat of a locomotive engineer came up behind him and stared dumbly at the automobile. "How in God's name did that derelict come to be on the tracks in front of my engine?" "It's a long story," said Bell wearily. "What's going to happen to it?" Bell spoke quietly, almost reverently. "It's going to be shipped back to the factory in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where it will be rebuilt until it is as good as new." "Fix this wreck?" said the engineer, shaking his head. "Why bother?" Bell looked at the locomobile with a loving expression in his eyes and said, "Because she deserves it."